Okay, so I'll just say an errata and a few things to try and tie everything together. Even some of the questions I was chatting with some of you yesterday, it's obvious that some things were not that clear. So how would we want to proceed? So first, let me just fix a few things I said yesterday were correct, and there was a question, where was the time, whatever, derivative. So imagine what we're trying to do is compute the rate of change of the energy, which if we use conservation of the stress energy tensor that we defined that way, the lambda Lichtman stress energy tensor, then we can start trading time derivatives by space derivatives. So the time derivative would be the rate of change of the energy. Then we computed the flux, which would then, by using the divergence theorem, we can go to an integral of the boundary. So the right component of the stress energy tensor is something like that, zero because it's the flux of energy, and I is the direction. Once we choose a surface that is a radial surface that is very large, then the relevant component of stress energy tensor is the component t0r in time and the radial direction. But OK, then the zero singles out a time derivative on h here, and the r singles out the radial derivative in the second component. And this is where I say, well, you can trade the radial derivative by a time derivative under the assumption that these are waves. And you pick up a 1 over c factor. And this sort of, so what was missing as I was going yesterday was this dot. I had written h, not h dot. And as a result, this has h already had the quadrupole derived twice, or differentiated twice. This gives us a third derivative, and similarly here. The other errata is when I wrote the post-Newtonian basics, in this component, or in the time-space component, I had a c squared, it should be c cubed. This is one order below the R2. And of course, if you do the counting here, I mean, the metric tensor, this is a side comment, has 10 components, and this is a kind of rewrite and kind of recasting of those 10 unknowns. So we have 3 here, 4, 5. And because this one was asked to have zero trace, we have 5 more here. So that's 10. Of course, the value and the usefulness of these quantities that have been introduced is in the context of really weak gravity, where these things become something that are useful. In particular, the scalar field, phi, and this R1, that I also will call it phi because I cannot pronounce the Greek letters, they, in the right gauge, you can make them equal. And this leads to the standard Poisson equation for Newtonian gravity. So the Newtonian potentials are these two. And in the right, with the right choice, they will be equal. And the equation will be Laplacian phi equal rho. This one will kind of encode the frame dragging in general relativity. And this, everything else, in particular, gravitational waves are hitting in here. So remember, just as a brief review and just to kind of clarify the exercise, remember the first thing we tried to do is kind of identify that indeed the theory has got the gravitational waves and some of the properties of their propagation. So in the right gauge, we were able to write that because we're thinking we're outside, far from the source. There is no stress energy tensor that is sourcing them. We're just saying the propagation. So we have a wave equation acting on H. This is the trace reverse version. And this was in this harmonic Lorentz-Hilbert de Donder gauge where this is true. The solution, the general solutions to this equation are like so. Or this is a collection of plane waves. That implies that this vector, k, is a null vector. And then the gauge condition imply that that null vector is in the kernel of the polarization. These are, if you want, the collection of amplitudes of these waves, of which we have however many relevant components of the strain tensor there are. I gave one example, and I said, well, suppose the wave is propagating along the z direction. The null vector can be written this way, but that's one null vector. Any factor times that null vector gives you another null vector. And so now let's just think what this gamma is. So if we I write this k tilde, let's say it's gamma the rk. If we do the product of k times xa, xa being our coordinate, for a wave that propagates along the z direction, this is just gamma t times gamma z. So what we would have in the exponential is e to the ik xa will give us, and then of course all this is complex, so it was understood, and I didn't say it, that we have to at the end of the day take the real component or add the complex conjugate of that so as to have a real expression for h, because of course h is real. So then this just gives us a sine of gamma t times plus gamma z. And so here, if you remember your wave theory, so you might have written wave solutions as sine of omega t plus kz being the frequency and the wave number, and this is what you make that connection. But up to this point, because we haven't made any contact with the source, the frequency and wave numbers could be whatever. So just if they satisfy the null condition, it would be a solution to our problem. So where do we get the information, what's the frequency of the wave or what's its wave number? Well, for that, we need to make contact with the source itself. So we picture a source doing something, us being an observer some distance away, and we obtain the relation between the amplitude, if you want, or time-dependent values for the stress, for the strain tensor, the deviation from flat space, given by this relation, which has some constants there, a decay of 1 over r to the distance, and the second time derivative of the quadrupole at the retarded time. So we are looking back because the wave is coming on the null cone. We're considering flat space time, so we mentioned that if there is curvature, we also have signals within the null cone, but at this level of approximation, we're just seeing things along the null cone. And so now imagine you're here, we're at a specific distance, and if we're thinking, again, that this is an observer along the z direction, and this is a wave that is propagating along the z direction, so then we're evaluating this at some position z, let's call it z of the observer. So what that observer is seeing is h is a exponential I omega t plus k z observer from our previous discussion, because the wave is propagating to it. But at that location, then this is just a number, right? Z is not varying. What varies is t. But that's when we then say the left-hand side is that, and the right-hand side is providing us the connection to what the source is doing. And so once we evaluate this quadrupole and the time variation, we're going to be able to say, oh, that's what omega is. And once we know omega, we know what the wave number and the wavelength is. And so the exercise was think of having two objects. They could have mass 1 and mass 2, let's say. We have to evaluate the quadrupole. So the quadrupole in Wiggly equations is the density times distance square. It can be x, y, xx, and so on and so forth. The density, of course, at the level we're working, can be written as just a distribution of two sources, a mass here, that is at a distance, say, r from this axis that we have chosen to describe it. And then there is, if I'm using cylindrical coordinates, whatever its angle is phi minus omega t. We're assuming that these objects are rotating at omega. And then there is an r contribution. But because we have this x squared, then you're going to pick up contributions that go like sine square of omega t, sine omega t, cosine square of omega t, which you can then use trig identities to write things as sine of 2 omega t or cosine of 2 omega t. And this is where the frequency of gravitational waves becomes related by a factor of 2 to the orbital frequency. So the exercise, well, compute the amplitude, compute the energy, compute the rate of change. Just as a bonus, you can ask, well, how close should I be in order to hear it? Just think of you have two black holes of m of masses, let's say 10 solar masses. that are going around, or that they have a distant separation of, let's say, 100 solar masses. That's the distance. So 10 solar masses, and this would be about 150 kilometers. And then just ask, how close should you be? So this is the R here. How close should you be from system four? The rate of the, and remember, we did the calculation that the change, the rate of change, or the distance will be modified by whatever distance is plus 1/2, let's say HXX. So just think of this introducing a distance of about a millimeter. And then your ear will pick it up and you'll hear the waveform, the wave, you'll hear the collision, these two objects going about each other, two black holes going about each other, by the noise that your brain will pick up because your middle ear is moving. And the other one is, when you also compute the rate of change of distance, think of two black holes of, say, 10 to the 8 solar masses that are separated by 0.05 parsecs. And then just ask how long, under this simplistic assumption, would you have to wait so that the relative change in the length is about 1%. So this is the type of sources that could explain what NanoGraph claimed yesterday. Of course, there are different masses and different distances. They have this hum that is consistent with the claims that were presented yesterday. Any questions on this? Okay, so far what we've done, I'm going to draw one more time this thing. It's kind of the very, very early part, but a few things that we understood, based on this exercise, is that the frequency will be tied or will relate it in a very simple way to the orbital frequency. We also saw that the frequency will increase with time because these objects are getting together. And you can also see that as that frequency is increasing, the amplitude is also increasing. So this part of the waveform is showing a sweep upwards in frequency and a sweep upwards in amplitude, and this is what it's referred to as a chirping signal. Both frequency and amplitude is going up. Here, it's a god-awful mess that hopefully at the end of today, I'll describe some very basics of it. We're now going here. We're thinking, suppose somehow nature produced a black hole, maybe because there were two black holes that has collided, a star collapsed on itself, there was a supernova, and you lead to the formation of a black hole. You're trying to understand what happens right here. And we're going to ask the following question. Well, we're going to wait sufficiently long, however long we need to, so that we can assume that the space time is essentially quiescent, is quiet, has reached its very close to stationary equilibrium, and we're going to try and get some features of what the behavior that we could expect there is. So that takes us now into black holes and what we know. And so if we do this up to the year, maybe 2000, there wasn't a heck of a lot known about black holes. There were Einstein's equations are a very complicated theory of which solutions could be obtained from rather powerful calculations that assume a whole bunch of symmetries. And okay, so who knows what that implies in the dynamical regime? We now know a lot better, both by theoretical calculations and, of course, observations. But let's just kind of think that we're thinking around the kind of late 1990s. So up to that point, we knew that with theoretical black holes were known to be governed in stationary or static situations, so time-independent black holes. We're going by two, and if you're feeling generous, you can throw in a third parameter. I'm not that generous. And the parameters are the mass, the spin, and the potential charge of a black hole. So to keep a black hole charged is delicate because it would pull charges from opposite sign and eventually will neutralize itself. That's why people typically think of astrophysical black holes governed by only two parameters. We know, so black hole is a boundary of a spacetime that we cannot access, we cannot see inside, and one of the things they hide is singularities. And we're very thankful if it is indeed the case that all singularities are hidden from black holes, because then we can do physics as we know. Otherwise, we really don't know what we're doing. They are stable-ish, and this is what we're going to be discussing a little bit, and how we know that are stable, or how we have a feeling that they should be stable, and also discuss a little bit the ish, because this is interesting. We can also do this, and this I'll give it to you as a challenge. So black holes can join but cannot be bifurcate, and you can convince yourself essentially in two lines of reasoning using just the principle of equivalence that this is true. So just give it a try. If not in coffee breaks, you can ask me. It's actually a fun thing to think about. And then of course black holes is a conjecture. Yes.
What do you mean by bifurcate?
So you could have this process.
Right.
Okay. But you cannot flip it.
So that's, you can join them.
But you cannot split it.
Oh, yeah, right, right. Yeah.
So, so this is allowed. This is not allowed.
Entropy?
I didn't say entropy. I mean, you could use entropy, but I mean, that you're using more stuff. Just think of using just the principle of equivalence.
Yeah, it breaks the error.
You have to break time reversal invariant somehow.
Yeah.
Just use the principle of equivalence. And then it's in bottom line, the principle of equivalence at a point, the structure of the space-time is exactly like that of flat. In particular, the null cones have a particular structure. Just think of the null cones, and then you're going to say, this is possible, that's not. So I'm going to focus on the very simplest black hole, which is a Schwarzschild black hole, which of course, by definition, that black hole is not stable. Because if I perturb it with any little bit of angular momentum, it acquires it, it will start rotating, it will no longer be described by a family of these black holes, but this black hole, the general black hole, the Kerr black hole that has mass and angular momentum, that's the one that should be stable, but we're going to be saying things about this one. Yes?
That perturbation will not die over time.
Well, that's what we're going to look for. But even if it dies over time, so imagine you have a non-rotating object. So in the context of mathematics, stability means if you have an object described by a family of solutions, I'm thinking the family of solutions of non-rotating black holes is described only by the mass. So if I throw it a particle that contains no angular momentum, it will give me a black hole that is slightly heavier. But that's that, and the solution will be a member of this family. But if I now send it with a small angle that introduces some actually angular momentum, it will no longer be described by this. It will have a small rotation and cannot be described by this metric. Of course, that's a cheaty thing to say, because if I had started with a Kerr black hole, and that black hole was not at its maximum rotational rate, if I throw in a little bit, I only change the angular momentum by a little bit, it will still be described by one of these. But then there are things that those rotating black holes will do, and this is this ish thing that I added. So I'll just make a few comments, but we're going there. So, and what we're really going after is this thing, quasi-null modes for black holes, and I'll say a few more things as we go along. So let's take this solution. That's a non-rotating black hole solution, and then let's think of what are basic things we can do with that. And so one of that is to look at geodesics in such space-time. So we're thinking we have a particle that has, say, some four velocities associated to it. So its norm is equal to -1. Or we may have a photon which has, say, this tangent to it, so this one is 0. We can use that metric, solve the geodesic equations, and then try and ask what we can learn from their behavior. The other thing we know in this is we have significant symmetries. In particular, we have a symmetry associated with this vector. We have an easy way to say we have nowhere here anything depending on that time. And then we have another one, which is d phi. So these two symmetries give us two constants of motion, which we're going to call the energy, which is just 1 minus 2m over r. dt d tau, that's the parameterization of our geodesic. And the other one, which we're going to call L, is R squared d phi d tau. And so this is, if we were to take kind of the Newtonian analog, OK, this will be the energy. And this is the angular momentum that that particle will have in that spacetime. So this is standard material. I just want to go after a couple of observations. If you look at trajectories, in particular, let's say for the massive particle, this obeys the following relation. So 1 half d squared is 1 half dr dt squared plus v of r with. So we have a particle that's moving in the potential. So this would be the standard expression we have in Newtonian theory. So there's a constant that is going to be, if you want, fulfilled by a particle that it has potentially some amount of kinetic energy and some amount of potential energy. And depending on what the shape of this potential, then we're going to have different behavior for that particle, given assuming it has some energy and some angular momentum that is showing up here. So all these three are very familiar. They behave, I mean, just as Newtonian theory. But general relativity, or the solution, this black hole solution, adds that piece. So you can see that as r gets sufficiently small, this term will dominate over everything else. And so a particle that gets close enough will just keep falling faster and faster towards r equal to 0. And I'm thinking circular orbit, sorry. Suppose now I think of circular orbits. So I'm trying to think what happens if I set dr dt equal to 0 and I'm asked if there are any special points. And you can convince yourself quite easily using this potential and taking the dr dt equal to 0 that there exist circular orbits which are stable. And I'm going to put in between quotes before I say, I'll get back to this again in a second, if r is larger and equal to 6m. It looks like a G. I'm sorry, I put in between quotes because we're thinking of a particle. So we're assuming that that particle interacting or going around the central object has no radiation associated to it. So nothing is taking energy away from the system. So under that assumption, up to 6m from large radii, you can establish stable circular orbit. But if you try to put them at smaller than 6m, it's unstable and it will fall in. So this is in sharp contrast to what the situation is, of course, with Newtonian gravity. So if we go back to that plot over there, if we can begin to wave our hands, just give me a second, that this may be, imagine you have, this was for two objects. In fact, in here, in that exercise, we didn't necessarily make the assumption that one is, that the two are the same. We could have imagined one much smaller than the R1. So imagine you make one very large and happens to be a black hole. The R1 is very small and is a particle. And so this thing is just going on circular orbits, maybe losing ever so slightly energy using the arguments that we had before. But at some point, it's going to get close enough that it has no choice, but it has to fall into the main object. And this is what this thing is saying. If you're trying to think of the system as having a sequence of quasi-adiabatic circular trajectories, there is a point where it just falls in. And so the transition, if you want, of a quasi-adiabatic circular motion to essentially a plunge may happen, or does happen in that extreme case where M1 is much larger than M2, and let's say the central object has no spin, happens at that radius. So yes, you have a question.
So what do you mean by that R is greater than or equal to 6.7?
Right, so if you take the standard calculation, you say, dr, where is drdt zero? What are the conditions for a circular orbit? And then you would find solutions to any possible r. But then you ask, what is the second derivative of r? And then you're going to have the change in sign when you cross 6m. And so it's stable for large radii and unstable for smaller radii.
Is m a mass or?
M is the mass that here, that's the mass. And it's the mass that shows up here. It's the mass of the black hole. So you have a particle.
But then R, that's a radius. What do you mean by the
is it place? There's a factor of Newton's constant there too.
Yeah, so Newton, G, is that where you, huh? Is that where you're worried about the Newton's constant?
Or what?
I mean, I just want to know, are you worried about G? Missing G?
I guess it's just, just dimensions here.
Oh, yes. G is 1, C is 1.
Okay.
H bar, I don't care.
Okay.
Where are the label where 2 pi is equal to 8 pi is equal to 1?
I mean, okay.
I mean, I can pull the dimensions again if you want, but.
Okay, that's fine. I just wanted to clarify that.
Okay.
Thanks.
No, thank you. Sorry, I should have said that. The other thing is if you ask about, now instead of massive particles, you think of photons or massless particles. Then what you find, and again, you can ask at what point can a zeta particle moving in a circular motion what's the last time where I can put a circular a particle in circular motion for the massless case? And then there is also another key radii there, which is 3m, and this is known as the light ring or the photon sphere. And this, incidentally, is what the Event Horizon Telescope home scene to say this is the last area or the last region around a black hole from which we can have significant emission coming out.
Is it stable or not?
It's unstable.
It's unstable.
Is that emission also, like that behavior also for, let's say, gravitons or gravitational waves?
Yes, and this is where I'm going there in a second. In fact, there is a way to link the frequency of the light ring with this quasi-null modes that we'll introduce in the very large angular momentum limit. So as you think of, because here we're talking about particles or photons, but we're thinking of a very small object that is going around. Because when we talk about wave optics, we have to be careful because a wave has a spread. But if you take the Iconon limit, or you think of the frequency, the very high frequency limit, the very, very short wavelength limits, then the results of the particle, or the results of the wave optics kind of coalesce or approach the results of the particle. So this is, if you take the infinite frequency approximation or the Iconon approximation, then the two begin to give you the same answers.
And another question. If we study, for example, two black holes, like this, can we find a region, an allowed region for radiating, from which the, let's say, gravitons or gravitational waves are coming out?
Yeah, I mean, that's okay. Can you hold that thought in?
The place where we have the strongest field would be not allowed for radiating.
That's an excellent question. Can you hold on? Let me just build a few more concepts, and then, I mean, if I don't go there, please let me know, because there are some interesting questions on points of discussion nowadays, and it has to do with some of the open problems that gentleman behind you was also asking me to comment, so I'll try and make some comments that are general. But that question is very much being debated hotly these days. Okay, so this is for a non-spinning black hole. Now, if you add spin, what changes? Well, lots of things change, but very similar to this, you're going to have less circular orbits, both for stable, for massive particles and for massless particles. One thing that changes in the case of a non-spinning black hole, there is no sense of special orbits. But if you have a black hole that has, say, has angular momentum in this direction, one thing is to come with angular momentum that is the orbital angular momentum that is aligned or misaligned. So then these circular orbits being stable, this radio bifurcates in two. There is one for prograde orbits and one for retrograde orbits. But by and large, qualitatively, this is still there. And so is this one. So doing the calculation for the case of Kerr black hole goes through the same lines. But we have to be careful that now trajectories are more general. We need to take into account that where we're coming, say, with an equatorial orbit or with an inclined orbit, we need, it's a bit more delicate. Here we make use of two constants of motion. There is a third constant of motion that you can use in the case of Kerr, which is called the Carson constant. So everything that we set here kind of extends to the Kerr black hole case, but it's going to be more nuanced, the calculation. So I'm not going to go there, but just to say qualitatively, all these things can be found in the Kerr case. So one thing, let me just say one thing. So if I draw for a Kerr black hole stable circular orbits, then now they depend on the spin. And so you have circular orbits for, let's say, minus 1 to 1, that's 0. So this is the A over M. Or say angular momentum of the black hole divided by its mass square. So for 0, this is our 6m. Now, if we have a particle that is going in a given orbit and we spin in the opposite direction, then this is at 9m. And if we go in the same direction, this happens to be at m. So, and the behavior is rather, okay, I didn't do this very nicely. It's rather flat, and it falls quite sharply as the spin is close to 1.
What's over M?
The spin parameter.
Oh, spin. Okay.
Yes. And so associated to that, just qualitatively, so suppose we have a particle that is coming, and it's encountering a black hole that happens to be spinning in the opposite direction. This tells us that the plunge towards the black hole happens when they are sufficiently far, because it can no longer sustain a circular orbit from that point of view when it's at 9m. But if it's coming to a black hole that whose spin is aligned with its orbital angular momentum, it can keep going quite a bit, quite a long time before it has to fall in. So associated to that process, the frequency of the plunge, that we would, if we want to picture it this way, is much lower for a retrograde case than a prograde case. And that's not a shabby thing. So it's a factor of 9. It's quite a bit of a difference, which then means, as we'll discuss in a bit, this case will radiate significantly more than that case, I mean, once you consider the full process. Yes?
Yeah, are there estimations on the usual spin parameter for the black holes we have in our universe?
To behave?
What would be a usual parameter, a usual value? What would you expect?
Oh, cute question. Let me answer that. In connection with that involves Cliff, but Cliff has nothing to do in this story. Some of us saw the paper that LIGO was about to put a few weeks before. And the first reaction that I had is, holy S, because the spin that was measured for that event was close to 0.7, that A, mm-hmm. which is the spin you would get if two non-spinning black holes are coming together, forming a final black hole that essentially has twice the mass. So all that spin that that finite black hole has is provided by the orbital contribution to the total angular momentum. So that said, here is the first event that the gravitational wave detector see, which is completely consistent with black holes that come with zero spin. So it's very strange to ponder or to think of a context in which black holes are formed and have no spin. I mean, like, that's very strange. We just argue that this solution is the unstable solution. Any angular momentum that is floating around there that could acquire will try to acquire. So how come? But the story has gotten very rich. So far, most of the events that the gravitational wave detectors have observed are consistent with extremely small spin, which is something that has everyone puzzling and thinking about.
So that's not a selection effect. It's not like they have trouble seeing.
No, it's not a selection effect. I mean, you could argue that to some degree there might be some, but not in general, because you see many masses, so there is some bit of degeneracy, so I can have black holes that have slightly more mass or slightly less mass and half spin or no spin, and I will still see them. So it's not a significant selection effect. And as I said, if you're trying to maximize the amount of radiation you're detecting, you're more sensible for high spins that come aligned. And you could argue, well, high spin and kind of aligned is natural if I produce them in the same process by which two stars were too close. Somehow the common envelope kind of align everything. So you expect maybe all these things to be adding. So then to have the no spinning case is an interesting thing, which goes very deep into the heart of the astrophysics that formed those objects in the first place. But now one of the things that people are very interested in trying to find more events with spin, because that can really help disentangle what process formed the black holes in the first place. In particular, everyone is trying to find a case where they come together, or it would be very exciting, and there's significant evidence of the spin in the opposite direction, which will favor the channel of formation of dynamical captures of black holes that were formed in a different way, and somehow they are assembled. They were not formed together. Okay, so now let's try and do a bit more. So we're thinking of that late stage. So the black holes just form in whatever ways you can think of. Maybe this is one of them. And we're going back to trying to solve what happens with our waves. Remember, so back in the first class, we said, well, we're assuming the space-time is fairly flat, and we're trying to see what happens with the generation and the behavior of the waves. Here we can't make that argument anymore. But we can try and do the next best thing is to say, well, we have a black hole. As I said, we're going to wait long enough for us to make this statement consistent so that the black hole is almost quiescent. We're trying to ask what happens with the last kind of cries of that black hole trying to get to a stationary state. So we want to think that our metric is given by a background metric. So before we were putting the flat metric. Now we're putting a black hole metric background. So here we would put, say, Kerr. And then we picture that there is a small perturbation, and we're trying to solve for that guy and ask for his properties. So as it's usually the case, rather than getting immersed in the mess of these things, you already saw we need to fix a gauge and make sure that we're doing things consistently. We can do a primer of that and imagine that we have a metric, it's G background, and rather than thinking of a perturbation of the space-time metric itself, let's think we throw in a scalar field. I mean, this is something we can always do to try and probe a little bit what the phenomenology of this problem would be by thinking, okay, how when this object, a scalar field, moves in the space-time provided, in an unchanging space-time provided by this black hole metric. Yes?
Yeah, curiosity. So when you say fix the gauge, so for example, would it be possible to pick a gauge that's analog to the harmonic gauge in the general curve background?
Yes, definitely. But we're trying to see about first generalities, and then we promise that there is a way to follow that through in the general case, but let's just stake on the more thing, on the most general, more general and simpler calculations. So what we're asking is to solve this. If we're thinking of a massless scalar field, we'll put a zero here. If it is a massive, well, when we put a mu squared phi, and I'll say a few things here, but let's just start, stick to this case first. Okay, and also for simplicity, let's assume that we're in the Schwarzschild case. So we have a black hole that doesn't have any spin. So we're solving for that. We have a metric that is, we're using this metric, let's say. It's diagonal. It has all sort of symmetries. So let's take advantage of that. So we're going to assume that phi can be written as some function that only depends on the radial direction. So one YLM of theta and phi. And that it has, perhaps, we're going to cross our fingers, and has some harmonic time dependence. So this is our ansatz. We're going to say, well, is there, can we find solutions of these? And also because we're thinking about far distances, and once we kind of expand what this equation is, and powers of R that will show, it will be convenient to think of this R as being divided by R. So I could have had, if I postulate that, then I can have an R twiddle divided by R. So I can just make that R explicit. Yes?
Yeah, I can see that that's making sense in the Schwarzschild case.
Yes.
But if it's the Kerr metric, then you don't have you know the spherical symmetry.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And then you have to introduce a really complicated thing. You have to introduce a basis. So there what you do, very much like what we did there, you're going to introduce a decomposition that is convenient. So you can introduce a decomposition where some components of the H is divided in three classes. There are some components that are scalar, if you want, just like this phi and psi that we introduced there. Then we're going to, another subset will be vectors, very much like this omega I that we have there. And a third class will be tensors. So associated to those, then you're going to introduce a spherical harmonic, which kind of an expanded set of spherical harmonics, which are a basis of the scalar space of functions on the sphere, tensor vector space of functions on the sphere, and tensors. So you have to introduce all that mess.
Right.
And then massage the equations enough so you have something simple at the end of the day.
So that still works in the non-spherically symmetric way, but you just have to do what you did. It's more complicated.
It's more complicated, but you can follow through.
Right.
And the beauty at the end of the day for the Kerr black hole is that the equations do become separable.
Right.
But that's a little bit of a magic. If you think of other line elements, it's not necessarily the case. So if you plug these in here. Again, we're doing a linear calculation, so we can solve for individuals R and M. We have postulated the full solution, even the time dependence here. Once you do that, then you can find that the equation that determines solution, and should have put R L M here as well. You can find solutions provided a physical, now you have to postulate what's the physical problem we're solving. So we're saying, first thing first, this is a metric. Remember, this is a matrix. It's a representation of Schwarzschild solution that happens to be singular at r equal to m. It's a coordinate singularity, but we have to deal with that. The way we deal with that is we're going to introduce another quantity, which is called the tortoise coordinate that pushes this to minus infinity. So we have a problem where in that r star coordinate, the tortoise coordinate, so the black hole is sitting here at minus infinity. The observer might be at far distances. So we're saying if we're arbitrarily close to this boundary, the waves described by the scalar field are purely outgoing or purely infalling to the black hole. At arbitrary far distances towards infinity is purely outgoing. So nothing is kind of producing a perturbation here that is coming in. We're always pushing this sufficiently far out. And then when we find what the solution of this, then we have an equation of motion for R. It's an equation. Let me just give you roughly what the equation is. It's a second radial derivative, or this RLM, with respect to this tortoise coordinate twice, plus omega squared. That's the omega that we postulated in our ansatz, minus some potential of R acting on RLM equal to zero, where this potential is given by so this equation, subject to these two conditions, and this potential, can be solved for multiple values of that omega. So first, one observation is for this particular case, it does not depend on m. I don't see little m. So the asymmetrical, or the number on the that describe oscillations in the equatorial plane, it doesn't show up. So it's going to be independent on the m, but it's going to be explicitly dependent on the l. So we find, or one finds solutions, omega, l, m is irrelevant, but we can keep it there. But then you also find that there are an infinite number of solutions once you fix the l. And even if you fix the m, but the m does drop out. And so then you put another number there, which is an n, which is called an overtone. So this is the angular momentum parameter. I forget what the name of this one is. And then the overtone. But the one thing you see is that this thing has both a real part, let me call it here, and an imaginary part. Or I put an R here. The important thing is that this, in this way, this only describes decaying and this is why in this case you would say at least for scatter perturbations the Schwarzschild black hole is stable because we kick it, nothing wants to grow. And then this one is oscillation. So what this is showing is that if you impinge on a perturbation or you set a perturbation at any given time, the solutions governed by this behavior is like so. And this behavior is at least qualitatively very similar to that behavior. These are things, so these things are called, and going back to a previous question, quasi-normal modes. And here you could have, there are two reviews that I'm suggesting you might, if you're interested, you could read. There's a kind of an old review with Kostas Kogota and Bernd Schmidt. But this is an old subject. There's, I mean, already this contains everything if you want. And then there's a newer review of Berti, Cardoso, and Starinets, which is much broader. It, not only this one was thinking about 3 plus 1 black holes, this is thinking about higher dimensional black holes in anti de Sitter. These are black holes in 4 dimensions in asymptotic flat space time, and this is everything else.
In what does that decay?
Say again.
In what does that decay? Like if we regard this Dirichlet wave to be
right.
Made of gravitons.
In what does this decay? What do you mean? What? So these are waves.
They're waves, and they're like disappearing.
They're not, they are either, so great question. Two things are happening here. Remember, our boundary conditions were conditions such that energy could be lost towards falling into the black hole or could be lost towards going infinity. In fact, an exercise I was going to suggest you guys do, think of that equation again. If you want to do it in 3 plus 1 in spherical symmetry, fine, but even if you do this in 1 plus 1 dimension, so just write that alignment, think of something that mocks that potential, that has a particular shape. So just draw these, you will have some shape. Try and approximate that with 3 segments, that one that has a potential that is just a collection of 3 flat potentials, and solve that problem subject to those conditions. If you want that to do that before, imagine no potential whatsoever. Imagine this doing this in a box. If you set up reflecting boundary conditions, this is the problem you've solved time and again in both electrodynamics and quantum mechanics, where it's just you're going to get standing waves in a box. And then you will find that these omegas, or the analog of these omegas, are purely real. So this is just the normal modes in the box. You're not losing any energy. That is why they're called the normal modes. The moment you allow losing some bit of energy in whatever boundary, then you pick up the complex frequency. And in particular, this is the one that would be telling you, oh, the system is losing energy. So your question is, you're describing waves propagating on this background spacetime that can be lost to infinity or into the black hole, and this is the decay. So the rate at which they decay has to do with the potential that, if you want, wants to keep it inside versus the inside this box, versus also the potential shape that here wants to allow things to fall very readily into the black hole if you're sufficiently close, and here that it can allow us to escape to infinity. Now, you allow me to make another connection. So you say, well, this thing is in fact for very high wavelength, very high L. So if you take the very high frequency regime, the kind of the icon L, then you can tie this to the behavior of massless particles around the 3M. So if you just take a photon that is at 3M plus a little bit outside versus a photon that's 3M minus a little bit outside, and you ask, what's the rate at which these two photon trajectories are diverging? You can connect that rate to this thing, to that thing, sorry, to this, to the oscillatory part. So there is a way to connect the quasional mode behavior to what high frequency waves would be doing. So that's where you think, if you're thinking now in the gravity picture, or in this, whatever the quantum analog of the scalar field, is you're asking what these kind of particles are doing when they're very close to having no choice whatsoever. And this would be the massless case, because we haven't put a mass here, have no choice to and they have to either fall in or escape to infinity. They cannot stay there.
What happens if you put two entangled particles, one on one side, the other?
I said H bar was zero here, so. I mean, there people do semi-classical calculations, the entanglement. Well, it would be entangled at large distances, and there is no problem to it. But I'm getting way out of what I really am trying to cover here. So one more observation, again, at the qualitative level, is this one. So remember, we were thinking box phi equals zero. So what happened if I put a mu squared phi here? And you go through the same exercise. Well, if you go through the same exercise, in Schwarzschild, nothing happens. You do have a little bit of dispersion, because now the propagation of these waves know that there is a mass. And so now we have something that we hadn't encountered so far, which was, depending on the frequency of the waveform we're discussing, the wavelengths, different wavelengths propagate at different effective speeds. But aside from that, they decay, they behave nicely, and all that. If instead of a Schwarzschild black hole, I put a Kerr here, black hole, so there has a non-zero A over M. So something interesting happens. You go through this, though being mindful that now that phi cannot be easily expressed solely in terms of a decomposition in terms of spherical harmonics. One has to introduce the spherical harmonic, the vector spherical harmonic, and the tensor spherical harmonic. But by and large, the process follows the same lines. But you find that there are, for some relations between the frequency that you might find as a solution and this mass parameter, you might have now exponentially growing solutions. So there exists exponentially growing solution. For massive And this comes under many names, but one of them is the phenomena of superradiance. So this is because Kerr black hole has a funny thing associated to it. It has something called an ergo region. Remember, we said we have a symmetry, d dt. A was a vector associated to a symmetry of the space-time in Schwarzschild dimension, but it's also a symmetry in Kerr. Associated to this vector, somewhere over there, we said we had an energy here. Well, the funny thing with that energy, the analog energy in the case of Kerr, within the ergo region is that it changes sign. And then you can imagine picturing scenarios where you take energy out of the ergo region, and rather out of the rotation of the black holes, and give it to the field. So this is what superradiance is doing. And it's related to what you might have heard called Penrose process. Same thing, you're taking energy of the rotation of the space-time, giving it to the particle that is going to infinity, or the field that is going to infinity. And this, going back to open problems, this is a problem that is not necessarily open because it has been solved. What the future development of the superradiance instability is has been solved by Willis here at Perimeter and Franz Pretorius. But the applications of it in interesting setups is still not wide open, but there are some very explicit suggestions for axions, and this is work by Minar Vanitaki and collaborators. But there could be also in many different contexts, in particular even this superradiance plays a role in the holographic applications. What was I going to say? I was going to say something else over there. No, I think that's it. It doesn't, of course, make a heck of a difference in the binary black hole problem because there we're talking about massless particles. But if they were to be interacting with another field, like again the action field, then you could have some very interesting phenomenology being produced where the black hole mass and the black hole spin end up being modified by this field that is taking energy and angular momentum away from them and putting it somewhere. Yes.
Does it work for massless modes in the case in which we consider the coupling with the curvature? Like when we solve for.
Yes, but that's right. So you have, and thank for that question. I did mention something in the first class. It works in roughly the same way, except that it loses, so the stamina of that process it gets lost. As you move slightly away from the black hole, the curvature is going down. So the effect is like having this mass that as you go further and further, the masses go into zero. And so it doesn't have a lot of influence. But this is responsible, this superradiance case, or this superradiance effect, is responsible for my ish, right? So imagine now you have a Kerr black hole that is interacting with some massive field out there. So you now lose some energy, you put in the field, and then now you have a black hole that is described by the two parameters M and A, but also what is going on with the structure around it, and this is the hair. It's called, or it's referred to as a hair of a black hole. It's something where the black hole has some other parameter, which is now the mass of your field, and maybe the state at which the field has been populated. So from that point of view, it's not stable anymore because it's not going to be described as another member of the Kerr solution. But the space-time in itself is stable. Nothing weird happened. It's just move energy a little bit around. Any other question? Yes.
Why people, actually I have read some papers that people, instead of the scalar field, they consider non-abelian classical field, and they hope to get hair from black hole.
Right.
Why it is the case?
Okay, so why it is the case? So let's see, at the bottom level, it's just any time you have a field that is massive, that its mass can be in the right range, because this mass has to be in the range. So let me just give you the range. Or, well, it should be commensurate if you want, to the parameters of the black hole, the mass and the natural rotational rate of the black hole. So if that's the case, then you could have this effect happening. If you look at what the, so you're going to have, if you have super radians, you have this imaginary part with the wrong sign, so that it grows. But depending on how big it is, the growth rate can be quite rapid or could be extremely slow. So if it is extremely slow, it might be irrelevant for practical applications. So when people consider, instead of kind of boson scatter fields, they think about other types of field, because some of those will have a growth rate that is much more rapidly. And so they can have a strong impact in kind of a reasonable time as opposed to other models. So people are looking or constructing different models, either because they are going after a very specific physics target, or because they're trying to find a way to maximize the impact of a phenomenon like that.
And really, we can get information classically inside the black hole or from the history of the black hole by those complicated.
So this is classical, the black hole exists. So we're not going to get any information from inside. We're getting information from the surrounding of the black hole, the structure of what it is. And then what we're getting information, if you want, is of the characteristics of this interacting field. So if you're using, say, axions to try and describe dark matter, it would be telling us if you have a positive, or even if you don't have a measurement, that whether that mass is allowed, where it is having an impact. If it's not, then you're putting a constraint on what the mass value should be. So the other interesting observation, or key observation, about these quasi-null modes, even if we forget about super radians, I suppose life is easy, we put at zero here, is that these quasi-null modes, even though I said, now in Kerr, in Schwarzschild, I said the M doesn't matter, but in Kerr, it does. So it depends on L and M and N. And it has a real and imaginary part, which of course depend now. Let's think of, well, we're not turning super radians. If it's going to interact with something, it's going to be a massless field. And so we're still in the case where the two parameters are governing the day. So these guys also depend on M and A. And of course, maybe L, M, and N, but these are fixed numbers that I can choose. So a key component of now it is kind of research in gravitational waves is to try and measure more than one mode. Because notice, if you measure one of them, you're getting two numbers. You get the real and imaginary part. From the oscillation, I can get the real. From the decay, I can get the imaginary part. So that's two pieces of information for every mode that I measure. So if I measure one, I can infer just from them what the mass of the black hole and what the spin is. Right? Are we good there? And if I measure a second one, that's a very stringent test of that black hole being governed by this Kerr solution, because they are all determined by just two parameters. So if I have a way to get those two parameters, then I immediately know what the answer should be. Even without having, if you want, solve or either care or seen what happened before. I just say, well, like, wait long enough, I see something that is decaying. I can ask, is that a black hole? What are the parameters? And is it consistent with it being a Kerr black hole? So one of the major pushes nowadays is here. And there's a lot of controversy going on because some people are claiming that they can measure two quasi-null modes, and some others are pushing against.
What's QNM, sorry?
Quasi-normal mode.
Well, quasi-normal mode.
Yeah, and the quasi is because they are not normal in the sense that they have that imaginary part. They are losing energy, and this is why they said it's quasi. So they're quantized just as your more normal modes, but they have that annoying but very important imaginary part, because it's telling us these black holes are trying to go to quiescence. Yes.
So it'd still be like, you know, eigenfunctions of the DNMs?
Oh, great question. They're not. Unfortunately, they're not. So they are. They do not form a basis. So we have solutions of black holes that are perturbed that cannot be represented by these quasi-null modes. So that in and on itself is another piece of, not controversy, of very active research. Because what is it that you do? And maybe this is the last thing I'm going to connect with. So suppose you have a way to get the full wave train. How? I'll tell you in a second. But let's say you just found the solution of two colliding black holes. They got whatever it had in store. And then you can ask, OK, I see the black hole coming to relaxation, because it's, I have just solved the full problem. And then you can insist, let me see if I can represent this behavior in terms of these quasi-null modes. Can I do it? And the answer is yes. By most part, when you say, can I fit that behavior with quasi-null modes, you can do a really awesome fit. So somehow, even though these are not a basis, they are really capturing what's happening here. Of course, and they have many messages associated to it. The time scale for relaxation, right, is of the order of the mass. So remember, mass in relativity has units of length and also units of time. So like everything scales with the mass. So within a few, I mean, an order of one of the mass, 10 mass, 10m, 30m, this is saying the space time should go quiescent. And indeed, this is what you see. So this conjecture, which is a conjecture that is not clear where it's Israel's or Penrose's, because they assign to each other, is this conjecture that says no matter how you collapse to form a black hole, that black hole will become a Kerr black hole. And so here, full solutions are showing in a very short time, you're awfully close to a Kerr solution. So let me just try and make a few further comments. So I told you how we can perhaps go up to here. We did a very, very crude first approximation using, and we obtained the quadruple formula, say. And we discussed that if they are sufficiently far separated, this is good. As you try to go further and further, well, you have to then include or worry about these post-Newtonian corrections, and people are going in higher and higher order, and try and push as much as you can here. And there is significant effort to try and create some smart resummations, and then these things come, or some resummations, let me take that smart out, that come under the veil of effective one body, which and are trying to, they take a page from what people know in quantum mechanics, and they are fairly successful. Part of the game is that the longer you can push that in an efficient way, then the more rapidly you can derive all the templates that you have to, at the end of the day, use to do the analysis and detection of gravitational waves. Then there is, as I mentioned, there is this effort of computing quasi-null modes, and this by and large is done, that people have done to just take a stab at the late time behavior. Of course, you can try and do better. So this is first order perturbation. You can try and put a second order perturbation, which in on itself is complicated, but people are doing it to try and see if you can push more from this side closer and closer to this thing in the middle. The problem is that, OK, at some point, you know that if you push them, if you push a decaying exponential backwards in time, it blows up. So you know that at some point, this approximation loses faithfulness. This thing relies on V over C being small. And you can estimate that when these objects are colliding, they're colliding roughly at the speed of very close to the speed of light. Another way of obtaining this is you can ask the question, what happens with this particle, remember, that got to r equals 6m as it plunges in, and as it plunges in very quickly, gets to have a speed of light that is a speed that is close to the speed of light, especially when it's about to cross this 3m. And so then the question is, what do you do here in the middle? And here is where we're out of luck. You cannot do any approximations that we know of, and then you need to do a full numerical simulation. So somehow you have to go back to, if you want this GAB equal to 0, if you're in flat space time, it over here considering stars equal to TAB, and here lo and behold, A pi is 1. And G and C, everything is 1. And so then Again, you have to face the same type of problems. We need to find the gauge, because otherwise these equations are underdetermined. A convenient gauge for a numerical implementation. Use heavy computer and high performance computing, and then you obtain a solution that kind of fills in the gap in between, and then you can do this matching between the in-spiral to the merger, and then the merger gives the right amplitudes for these waves, because we just say, well, there is an amplitude that is undetermined here. Any linear problem is a solution to it up to a constant. So how do you fix that constant? The ALM constants that are hidden in this solution are to be found by solving this intermediate stage. What is it? Of course, now what I'm going to try and say something about, well, let me say a few more words. So these are not simply wave equations. They're these very complex structures or set of derivatives that combined give you what would be the analog of that box with the corrections and interactions that curvature, which is actively changing and back reacting, has to be accounted for. So everything is there. And you build the spacetime numerically. In here, remember, when we wrote all our equations, this harmonic coordinates, I'll just give you one example of a gauge that is convenient, came up. If you rewrite what this is in terms of without making no approximation whatsoever, then this can be written in the following way, where you undo everything about covariant derivatives and make it into standard partial derivatives so that you can put them in a computer in a simple way. So you have terms like so. And here I'm being very rough. So what you have is a second derivatives of your unknown. Then you have first derivatives, let me write it this way, of your Christoffels. Remember, the Christoffels themselves are first derivative of the metric, so this goes like second derivative of the metric. And these are products of first derivatives. This first derivative times first derivative, and so here. So it's a whole god-awful mess, but the important thing is that this is the piece that contains second derivatives. This is a nice operator. This makes, it's unclear what it is when it contributes here. But if you go back and choose the harmonic condition, which was equivalent to setting the Christoffel, this is, by the way, is a trace of the Christoffel symbol. So this is gamma B is gamma AAB. That condition is the same as, let's say, or implies that this is zero. So this goes away. And then you have something that's sufficiently nice that you can attempt a numerical simulation if you work hard enough. That's true in general relativity. If you now open the door to beyond general relativity, you're on your own most of the time. There is no math, I mean formal math, that goes with you. So this is when physicists going crazy and doing the best they can. So if you are interested in beyond GR and you are wondering about what you have to do, be careful. Just drive with care. And if anyone is interested, I can talk about that. But of course, you're going to have to defend what theory and in what particular vein you're going to be working on. But aside from that, there's quite a bit of work nowadays being carried out there, even though people have in those beyond GR theories lots of solutions. There are some beautiful theories that people have written that have nice solutions for black holes, but we don't even know if those black holes are stable because of, to ask the analog question in here, given the complicated set of equations that might determine, is still quite open in many cases. So what are the open problems, at least, again, trying to make contact with that? So one open problem, and it's not open, but I mean it's a source of intense effort, is precision. This is a field that up to 80 years ago was trying to get that thing even roughly. That everyone would be happy if you had obtained that. And that happened in, that was the first one was 2005 when Franz Pretorius had the first solution of the collision of two black holes, and very quickly after the rest of the community was colliding all sort of things. But now, fast forward 8 years after the first detection, this is beginning to come and play a significant role. So it's no longer good to have the solution correct to first or two digits. You have to go very deep. And the more you're trying, the more precise you're trying to be, the more complicated things are. And of course, you need precision because the detectors are getting better and the noise level is getting pushed down. And now degeneracies are beginning to play a role. And there is, at the end, very, very important measurements that you're trying to make. So the precision frontier is one. The other one is mass ratios. So it's not so bad to do mass ratios here in the spiral regime. M1 and M2 can be whatever they want to be. Here, if you're going to wait long enough to do a linear approximation, then you're good. But if you're going to still try to fill in the gaps, things with numerical, with the solution of Einstein equations in the computer, this becomes a significant hurdle. The higher the mass ratio, the more complicated achieving the solution it is given the precision requirements you have. So that's another problem that people are dealing with. So in fact, to some degree, the binary black hole problem is solved. That shape is understood, provided you don't go crazy with mass ratios. So as long as you are in the M1, say over M2, order one, or maybe from 1 to 10 or 20, then you're good. But there will be sources that are much more different than that. Perhaps not so much in LIGO, but LISA is coming down the road, as you heard from Jess. 10, 15 years from now, you're going to have black holes, a supermassive black hole that is accreting or colliding with a star that might have 10 to the 5 mass ratio, way, way off from what numerical simulations can do nowadays. Of course, you can do a different type of approach. Remember, we introduced perturbations where we said, take V over C small. That was one. Take G small. That's an R1 approximation. The R1 is you could try and say, take M1 divided, or M light divided by M heavy, very small. And this is comes under the vein of extreme mass ratio in spirals.
ML over M?
M light over M weight, heavy.
Oh, OK.
Where you go back, and in some sense, your assumption is kind of like this, that you have a background, you have a small perturbation, you have a source, which is this particle that is going, or this star that is going around, and you're trying to make a consistent approximation to the solution of that problem. And there's very significant efforts going in that direction. And it's also useful because, well, you can imagine having a corner of B over C small, G small, and M over L small, which you're approaching through many different directions and filling the gap analytically, some results of what happens in the convergence where all these approximations are beginning to fail, but they all have something to say to complete the picture. And ultimately, and this is actually quite strongly motivated by new ideas that are coming from the EFT camp and also the amplitudes camp, which is to try and understand perhaps a potential way of resumming or having an effective Hamiltonian for what's going on here. And people like Rafael Porto and collaborators and others in the amplitudes community are taking advantage of or are pushing a program where maybe you can map the hyperbolic problem, the hyperbolic encounter, two particles that are just scattering off each other at really large speeds, and trying to see if the right analytical continuation tells you something about the orbiting case. Hopefully they'll get some really nice advances that might help with this problem. And this is something that is very new. So I mean, there are some reviews by Porto that you might want to take a look at if that's where that strikes your interest. I think at this point I'm going to stop, but I mean, just whatever questions you may have, I'm happy to try and give them a go.
Yeah, this point about the ultimate state conjecture.
Yes.
Do they posit that it's like the information, say, is like lost in finite time and you can't reverse it after when it's like, say, it becomes a curved black hole? So like, I guess what I'm asking is like, is that like distinct from, say, when you lose information through precision loss by waiting an infinite amount of time versus like, say, you know, like an information paradox kind of sense where it's genuinely lost rather than being a precision problem and needing?
No, this has nothing to do with information. You could perhaps try and make that connection that black holes are the place where you can maximize the entropy of the final object or something of the sort. But it has nothing to do with information. In fact, it was postulated even before, or people even were playing around with the entropy of a black hole, I think, if I go back in time, that I'm not so sure about, but it has been around for a long time. This is just a simple observation. If you're going to collapse an object, would it be a black hole first? Does it have to be a black hole that is governed by just these simple two parameters? And it goes back from that point of view in information. It's like the future state will have no recollection at the classical level of what it formed. That's that. But you could imagine that you're setting up, imagine bringing two near extreme curves. So they are at the verge of being singular, right? If you take A over M, this is why I had one as limit. So if you go back to Kerr's solution, at the one, at A over M equal to one, then, and also minus one, then you have a black hole horizon that is becoming singular. In fact, if you go a tiny bit to the plus, I mean, on the other side of one, you have a singular solution. So you can imagine I have two black holes that are maximum angular momentum. I bring them together. I'm adding onto the final black hole angular momentum, maybe at some point for the right configurations, or maybe I'm going to have a hyperbolic encounter that at the end forms a black hole. If I try and engineer a complicated collision, could I have the final state be a singular state because I exceeded the Kerr bound? I mean, so this conjecture is no. A Kerr solution will always win. And if you have too much angular momentum, you're going to radiate it away. And people have tried doing that in high-speed collisions. And time and again, the Kerr solution wins. And of course, then what happens in that case, you're doing that, then you come in with too much angular momentum, the objects are bound, so they go around each other like hell, very, very fast, radiating as much angular momentum radiation as they can, and then they fall in. And so you can, in those scenarios, you can radiate up to maybe 30% of the total mass of the system, and then you go to a Kerr black hole. And that's a whopping, I mean, if you compare it with nuclear processes where the efficiency of conversion of mass to radiation is about 0.1%, that you can end up with 30% or 20% radiation is of the budget that you had in to begin with is incredibly high.
In the extreme mass ratio case, is that case where you've got this point particle falling into a black hole? Is the radiation from that something which has been calculated analytically? Is that something which is there a limit there where you just know everything and you can just?
So in the limit, you have nothing. So in the particle limit, you have nothing. So because you're back to geodesics. So here, what you're trying to say, what's a back reaction? So it's going to off. It's like going back to the Abraham-Lorentz Dirac force for a charged particle in the ambient magnetic field or electric field. So here what you're trying to say, well, now is relax that particle assumption. Now you're going to allow for a system to lose some energy. And as a result, it's going to affect its own geodesic. It's not going to be geodesic anymore. The particle will begin to accelerate. So that is solved for, I think,
Poisson.
Poisson. There are many people that have that, but as far as what has been solved. I think for the case of Schwarzschild, for a scalar particle, that problem is solved to first order. I think maybe it is true also for the gravitational particle. I think for the Kerr case, perhaps only for equatorial trajectories, and people really want to work this out up to second order. If for now a reason to understand how big the error is of the first order approximation.
Where order is counting the ratio of masses.
That's right. And this is very relevant because this type of configuration in the context of LISA, they will undergo hundreds of thousands of cycles. And then if you're off by a radian, then you stop seeing them. And so then the requirement, this precision requirement is very high. And there is no way around it, because if you try to do numerics, there is no way you can do that, both for the error and just for the disparate scales that are involved. So the analytical approximation is the only way forward.
There's no other questions, and we should thank Luis again, not just for this lecture.